Public Radio News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. While expanding New Hampshire's local food supply won't be easy, there's one area where this state already shines. Face-to-face, personal contact between farmers and their customers. 12% of food produced here is sold directly to those who eat it, compared to a mere 0.5% nationally. Behind that number are the dozens of farm stands and pick-your-own operations decorating our landscape, and the impressive recent growth in community-supported agriculture and in farmers' markets. For a small state, New Hampshire now has 80 of these markets, including about a dozen that run in the wintertime. But while many celebrate this success, there's also a recognition that if New Hampshire really wants to boost local food, farmers may need more than direct sales. They need to increase their business with restaurants, grocery stores, co-ops, schools, hospitals, and to help improve food processing and distribution systems. But these tasks can be more challenging than getting a table at the farmers market on Saturday. And today in The Exchange, as we continue our week-long series on food called Eating In, we'll find out what those challenges look like and how those involved in local food are trying to get around them. Let's hear from you, too. If you're active in the local food movement as a grower, retailer, or interested consumer, what do you see as the missing links in New Hampshire's local food economy? What more could be done to strengthen New Hampshire food? And what models do you see other states providing? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, theexchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Sarah Zoe Patterson. She's founder and coordinator of Seacoast Eat Local, a grassroots group connecting producers and consumers of local food. And Sarah Zoe, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us, Charlie Burke, co-owner of the Weatherhill Farm in Sanberton. He's also president of the New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant Connection and co-founder of the New Hampshire Farmers Market Association. And Charlie Burke, thank you for coming in, too. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, as both of you have been involved deeply in this effort to promote New Hampshire grown, New Hampshire produce food. What do you think, Sarah Zoe? How have you seen this local food movement grow and change here in New Hampshire just in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years?
If we think back to 2005, even, local food was sort of a not prominent idea in people's mind. And there have been a lot of things in the national media that have helped spark people's attention locally. We've had, you know, these films, we've had books such as Animal Vegetable Miracle or Omnivore's Dilemma that have really gotten people thinking about this idea of local agriculture. And when Seacoast Eat Local was first founded in 2006, we were founded around this idea of there is all this great product here. There's so much food being grown here, and people are looking for it. They want it. They're ready, but they don't know where to get it. And so our group founded to provide that connection, to provide people the information they needed to access their farmers that were in their backyard, but maybe not, maybe it wasn't obvious where they should go to buy that food. And you know, one of the first things that we did as an activity was we participated in those 100-mile challenges that we don't actually really even talk about that anymore because we don't want people to think that local eating is something you do for a month as a challenge and then you stop and go back to behaving like you did before, but that this is the way we can eat every day, all year round. You know, as much as we want to engage in eating local food. And so, you know, our organization has evolved with the concept of local food and its availability. And we've really been able to take advantage of a lot of these concepts being brought forth in the national media.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later, I think, Sarah Zoe, about the year-round aspect, because that's new and growing. Charlie, I want to bring you into this, too. As I said, you're not only with New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant, but also the New Hampshire Farmers Market Association. What have you seen in the last 5 or 8 years?
Well, we moved here in 2000, and in 2001, we joined the Sanberton Farmers Market, and then there was a need for an association, which we formed then. There were 32 farmers markets in New Hampshire then, and now there are, I believe, 80 or so. So that's a dramatic difference. The farm-to-restaurant connection really was something that Jeff Page, who's going to be a guest today, you told me, and the Department of Agriculture tried to start up 12, 14 years ago, and there just were no chefs interested in that. The model didn't exist. And we started pushing it harder in, I think, 2004 when we had a meeting, a couple farmers and maybe one chef showed up. And recently there's been interest in Manchester for increased local food consumption in the restaurants. And Republic on Elm Street contacted me, and we sat with them, and they wanted to source all their meat and vegetables, and they're doing so. And then Jeff Page, who's friends with them, called me and ended up with a group of restaurants that wanted to talk. And we called a meeting in February at Cotton on a rainy, icy day, expecting maybe 10 or 15 people, and we were looking for extra seats. There were well over 60 people there.
Wow.
Farmers, bakers, the Littleton Grist Mill drove down. So it was really great. And there are the restaurants really are eager to use local products. That you can't pick up a magazine without being told to go to your farmer's market or to ask your restaurant what's local on the menu. So we think we're getting critical mass now.
Well, and I want to ask both of you, you know, you both talked about the tremendous growth that we've seen just in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. But Sarah Zoe, so at this point, what are people involved in this still trying to figure out?
I think a lot of us are still trying to figure out, you know, how do we move beyond people who are ripe and ready to access local food to helping people who it wasn't really on their radar. They weren't necessarily looking to buy locally grown products, but, you know, something has sparked their attention, or they're looking to feed their family healthier food, or they're looking to get more whole foods into their diet for their own health. And or they're an environmentalist and they care about how the food is grown and the inputs that were used and the outputs of the food system. And so I think one of the challenges is figuring out how to get people the information they need and how to support a growing food system. You know, as has been on the radio all this week, we know that we have challenges in land, we have challenges in processing and distribution. And so there are ways to address those challenges, and there's also ways to talk to people about what they can do themselves. Do you have to buy a chicken breast cut up in a plastic package, or can we all learn how to take apart our own chicken and get our own chicken breasts out of that whole chicken and become, you know, parts of the food systems ourselves? And there are, you know, a lot of different things in that regard we can do. We can be growing food in our own backyard. So while these challenges exist in land and processing and distribution, there's still a lot of room for personal growth in individuals participating.
You know, Charlie, UNH Professor Ross Cattell joined us to kick off the food series this week with some interesting numbers from a study he and Matt Magnuson did on local food. I'm sure you're familiar with it. One of the findings is that New Hampshire only produces about 6% of the food its people need, where our neighbors in Vermont and Maine do much better. What do you see happening in those two states that isn't yet happening here?
Well, I think you have to look at the support from the state government. We don't have the tax base here to match what they do. I tell a story about when the Rural Development Office of New Hampshire and Vermont was consolidated and obviously located in Vermont. And the meeting to discuss this was held at the Department of Agriculture here, and I was invited. And Gail McWilliam Jolly, who's the huge player in all of this and in charge of marketing for the Department of Agriculture, met her colleagues from Vermont. And five of them walked in. And they said, who else is in your office, Gail? And she just – there was one. So that was a classic example to me. And so you look at the support, tax support, I think that's huge. This is all – volunteerism, and it's necessary. The Farm to Restaurant Association, Farmers Market Association, a part of New Hampshire Made. It's really essentially a volunteer organization branding New Hampshire products and farm products. So I think that's huge, and we're working to work within our constraints.
Isn't that kind of the New Hampshire way, though, Charlie, that, you know, government doesn't provide the service, people kind of band together and do it themselves, like you are?
Well, yeah, if it works and it is working, then you're stronger than ever. It's like things that we're trying to do now during these economic times. If we get it right now, it's going to be much better when things improve. The biggest problem we have is distribution. This is a long, skinny state, and so it's hard for somebody up north to get their product down. Farmers are not very sophisticated and or have the time to do marketing and distribution. We came up with a virtual farmers market, thinking just to get the chefs hooked up with the farmers, so they knew what was in the area, and we did it geographically, figuring it was just a matching thing and let them develop their own relationships, payment, and so on. And we did this before all this local war stuff burst on the scene. And what happened was people tried to buy on this and couldn't because there was no shopping cart. And we're trying now to remedy that with a one-stop-fits-all, brand-new New Hampshire-made website, which will be for farmers and everybody, and it's going to be a unique, integrated, one of the first in the nation, we think.
Wow. Well, let me invite our listeners to join us. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here in the Exchange, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. As we talk about efforts to boost local food in New Hampshire's food supply, what do you see as the missing links in this effort? What more could be done to strengthen New Hampshire food? 1-800-892-6477. Charlie, real quickly, you mentioned different parts of the state. Where are the localism hotspots in New Hampshire?
Well, up in the Hanover area, obviously, there's a slow food movement there. The university towns, Dartmouth, Hanover, the Seacoast has a different demographic than a lot of the towns. Keene, the Monadnock, Peterborough area. And now it's starting to look like it's taking off in the Conway region, which you'll hear about later.
Right.
And basically, those are the hot spots, and we have to fill in the blanks.
Well, and I'll ask you later about the cool spots, and we will hear from someone from North Conway who's working on this effort. We'll also hear later on from some restaurant owners in Manchester who are heavily using local foods, and we'll talk to someone working with local fishermen. All that coming up, plus your call, so stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from Ocean Bank, offering its break-free checking account with direct deposit. More information online at eocean.com. Proud to be a division of People's United Bank, member FDIC. From Plymouth State University's Frost School, providing courses and degree programs for adults and working students online and on campus. Details at plymouth.edu/frost. And from the Balsams Grand Resort Hotel, Historic Hospitality, and Donald Ross Golf Course, hosting corporate events, weddings, and family reunions. Information at thebalsams.com. More on eating in and localism in New Hampshire on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan. New Hampshire weather for this afternoon, partly sunny, chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms, warmer too, highs today, lower 70s north, mid-80s south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're continuing our week-long series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In. We're looking at efforts to boost local food in the Granite State. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. One area of tremendous growth in recent years is direct sales by local farmers to restaurants. More New Hampshire chefs are getting involved in this. Exchange executive producer Keith Shields spoke with two of them at Manchester restaurants about their efforts to use local ingredients on their menus.
My name is Jeffrey Page, and I'm the executive chef and owner of Cotton Restaurant in downtown Manchester, New Hampshire. I've been bringing local foods into Cotton since we opened in September of 2000. There's several reasons why I like to bring in local food products. Being able to support local people who support me. And also, there's a lot of wonderful, passionate people out there who specialize in one thing. There's some great people who do nothing but make wonderful smoke products. There's other people who do vegetables, cheesemakers. A lot of great products here in New Hampshire that I don't think as many people are aware about that need to be aware of. And everything you can get pretty much from around the country, you can almost get it here in New Hampshire made locally. I would say like in the summertime, with the amount of produce and stuff we buy, I guess it gets up to close to like 75%. And in the wintertime, there is stuff available, but not as much. So, I mean, it probably drops down to like maybe 50%.
My name is Tom Puskarich. I'm the chef owner of Z Food and Drink here in Manchester, New Hampshire. I came of age as a chef in the late 80s, early 90s, living out in California. I'm from farm country, where long before there was the kind of localism that it is today. So it was already sort of ingrained into me, and it was already part of my cooking repertoire. A lot of our produce is not local yet. The season's just now getting going. My proteins, you have to define local. And I've defined local as within 300 miles. And probably about 85% of my proteins that are used in this restaurant come within a 300-mile radius. I'm working closely with a couple of organic farmers locally here this year. And once their fields get up and running, I expect to have about 75% of my produce coming from them.
Scheduling and communication between the restaurants and the farms, it can be difficult at times. We do all work different schedules. The nicest thing about modern technology is the internet. So myself, I do a lot of my communications late night after I'm done work. And it's great because you can not disturb anybody. And they're there when they get up at 5 o'clock when I'm still sleeping. So my notes are there to them in the morning when they get up. But it is a little tricky at times with the scheduling because everybody's so busy. We have two separate businesses that are both very, very busy, and it's not always easy to coordinate.
On any given week, we have 25 to 30 different vendors that we have for food alone. They each have an invoice. They each have their own billing cycle. So it does take an active role in management. For my kitchen manager, who's taken over the purchasing, probably accounts for about 10 to 15 hours a week of his time alone. And it's then getting the products here. These are all small businesses who sometimes are looking to get paid on delivery. And a restaurant like mine has been set up to be paying on terms, because they need the cash as much as I need to be able to sell the product before I could give them the cash.
The local farms are going up against the big, massive producers in California, Mexico, Florida. But I think the customer base has changed so much that they really want to know where their food comes from. And that helps in the pricing, where if you do have to charge a little bit more to get a locally produced product that's fresher, localer. And I think the people appreciate that more than they used to. People, I think, really care about what they're eating and what their children eat. For us, I mean, we've been fortunate enough that the pricing hasn't been too much of an issue.
To be able to look the farmer in the eye or make the phone call to a producer and ask him, this is the kind of lettuce I'm looking for, and him going out and planting the seeds and then bringing that into you, there's something more connected to your product than I'm ever going to get by just talking to my national big box food distributors. It's a very organic process, and it's something I sort of grew up in and very much like what I'm doing here in a much smaller scale of that.
That conversation with Jeff Page, chef owner of Cotton, and Tom Puskarich, chef owner at Z Food and Drink, was produced by Exchange executive producer Keith Shields. Join our conversation. We're talking about efforts to boost consumption of local food here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. As a consumer, what are some of the challenges you face trying to eat food that's locally grown? Or as a farmer or business owner, what are you doing to cater to the growing number of localvores in our community? 1-800-892-6477 or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. With me in studio, Sarah Zoe Patterson, founder and coordinator of Seacoast Eat Local, and Charlie Burke, co-owner of Weatherhill Farm in Sanberton and president of the New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant Connection and co-founder of the New Hampshire Farmers Market Association. Sarah Zoe, some of the challenges that came up in that restaurant piece, both chef owners very committed to local food, but it's not always easy.
That's right. And I love the point that they made that, you know, you have two businesses that are made up of people who are incredibly dedicated, but also incredibly busy. And they're both businesses that don't have the most generous profit margins, which means that when they dedicate 10 to 15 hours a week to procuring their products locally, that's an investment of their time and resources. We've seen farms who are interested in making it work because it works for their business model, and chefs that are interested in making it work because they care very, very deeply in it. There are farms who have just figured out that it's about the relationships. And if you can figure out, well, okay, I need to call this chef at noon on Tuesday, and that chef wants to be called at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, and but then condensing that down to what works for you as a business. And
right. It's easier just to make one big call to, as one of them said, the big box guy who can deliver it all in one fell swoop.
That's right. But because customers are saying, we care about this, it matters to chefs and their bottom line, but also, you know, because they care about the community that they're working in as well.
Well, we could do a whole hour probably on farm to table, but I want to share this email with you, Charlie. This is from Edward in Manchester. He says, I own Republic Cafe and Bistro in Manchester and have been working with Jeff Page and Charlie Burke since we opened in January. He says, I'm committed to using only New Hampshire raised beef, pork, lamb, and chickens. Both an uneven distribution system and the lack of processing facilities greatly hamper the farmer's ability to meet growing demand. We often find ourselves either out of the product or having to manage a less efficient system of delivery. This has come up all week, Charlie, in this series on local food, that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity in terms of local protein, meat, fish, chicken, but there's no processing facilities.
It's a huge problem, and there's a new facility just across the river in, I think, Westminster, Vermont, that will help that side of the state. And it is. It's a chicken and the egg thing. If we had more facilities, we'd have more people growing on their land because it's really economically difficult to truck your animals across the state for that. So if we can get more another facility – and to then more people growing, then this does look like it can be fixed. One of the things we're thinking about, that I'm not up on the latest legislation, but one of the possibilities is to have state veterinarians be meat inspectors and have a mobile unit. Very expensive, but it is not being done somewhere else.
A mobile slaughterhouse.
Right. And these can be done, and they're FDA approved and so on. The position of meat inspector was eliminated years ago because of the budget, and that's why we're kind of treading water. So this is something we have to look into. We're running up against budgetary constraints as well, but that would be a huge improvement if we had easy facilities for these farmers. I think you'd see a lot more grass-fed meat, and people are understanding why it's better to have it. It's healthier. It's a different animal. It's fed on its natural food rather than they weren't genetically evolved to eat corn.
Well, and this is a problem nationally, as
Absolutely.
I understand. People don't want slaughterhouses in their backyard.
Right.
At the same time, they're clamoring for local meat, so it's hard to know how to fix that.
One of the things I would say in that, too, is that people don't want the kind of slaughterhouses in their backyard that are these, you know, out-of-scale operations, that scale-appropriate operations would be welcome in the community. However, the USDA doesn't have guidelines or a setup or regulations that allow for small-scale models currently. So the lack of a state meat inspection program means we don't have the availability to do smaller scale models. We have to have that USDA size facility. And no, that would be hard to welcome into your community.
Well, especially again in New England, where a lot of the farmers are small and local. So, all right, lots to untangle. I want to invite our callers too to join us. 1-800-892-6477. First up is Amy in Putney, Vermont. Hi, Amy. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'll take my comments off the air afterwards, okay?
Sure.
First one is, I'm kind of chuckling because how many generations ago was it that all of our backyards were slaughterhouses and people were comfortable with this idea? So many people were killing off their own pig, their own cow on their own farm. In any case, though, there's one place that I haven't heard anybody mention. I'm part of the choir that you're preaching to. I'm going to go to the co-op. I'm going to go to the farmer's market. I'm going to buy local whenever I can. But there's a huge population out there that's not eating local products for the same reason they're not eating anything else from scratch, which is because they don't know how to cook it. We've lost we've got an entire generation coming up now, and I'm not talking about, you know, blue collar or white collar. It goes right across economic and cultural lines that doesn't really know how to cook.
So you join the CSA, but you come home with the big bag of greens and you don't know what to do with them.
You don't. And the thing is, you don't join the CSA because you know you're not going to know what to do with that big bag of greens. You know, to understand how to really use something, how to cook it one night, use the leftovers and soup the next day, use the peels to make, you know, soup stock, freeze or can the excess. We've lost that. And I never thought I would hear myself say this, but I think we need to bring back home ec classes.
You know, Amy, this is a great point and one that I had not thought of because I'm that person that will chop up the greens and make a soup and whatever. But you're absolutely right. What do you think, Charlie?
Well, I think that she's right. Incidentally, I wrote a recipe column for 5 years for theheartofnewengland.com, which kind of addressed that. And I think yesterday the farmer from Heron Pond Farm talked about a great program where they are growing food at a local school, and the food is being incorporated. This is being incorporated in the curriculum, and they're teaching cooking, and the kids can understand where it's coming from. But you're right. There are people that don't know. They've never seen a potato pulled out of the ground. And it is a problem. You know, I've taught a couple courses for Operation Frontline, which teaches people how to cook economically and healthy. But it's amazing. The basics are really lacking in spite of all the cooking shows and cooking magazines that you see on TV and here.
Right. It's almost like two different trends operating in tandem with each other. So, Charlie, what's the answer then? Is it to educate the population, as Amy says, maybe even bring back home ec, do columns like yours? Or is it for local growers to say, all right, people aren't going to cook. I not only need to grow carrots and chickens, I need to start making my own chicken pot pies. And, you know, you can put that in the microwave.
Yeah, but then you're getting into huge regulatory problems and licensing for these people to do that. I think education is obviously the answer. We found at the farmer's market that if you put a little recipe card up for collards or kale, what's kale? Well, you just, you know, then people buy it. So that's one thing that we have been doing.
Quick thoughts from you, Sarah Zoe.
I wanted to also make that connection between a common complaint about local food and cost questions. You know, is it more expensive? And the connection between cooking skills. It's not more expensive if you can cook. And so learning to cook also addresses a lot of things about, you know, that cost question.
Another issue that was raised in the UNH report on local agriculture that I talked about earlier is the low profitability of New Hampshire farms and how sometimes the business side of farming is where those who aspire to farm run into trouble. I want to talk more about that now with Suzanne Brown. She's executive director of the New Hampshire Institute of Agriculture and Forestry. Suzanne, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura. Good to be here.
And you're based in North Conway, correct?
In North Conway, that's absolutely correct.
And when and how did you get started? I have to admit, Suzanne, before yesterday, I had not heard of the New Hampshire Institute of Agriculture and Forestry.
Well, there's a good reason for that, because we're fairly new. We incorporated last September, and we actually took a page from the Book of Technology, which has a number of incubators throughout the state as well as throughout the country. And my thought was, if there are barriers to entry for farmers, and boy, oh boy, there are, why don't we take a look at creating an agricultural business incubator? And so that's exactly what we've done, and we've looked at all the models across the country and the world, for that matter, and we've come up with a formula that we think will work, in that any aspiring farmer who has basically the right stuff, similar to the astronaut program, if you will, we will bring them on board, get them started on our large farm on a track that matches their business plan, and they can come to us with really no idea what a business plan is all about, and we will teach them. They really just need to be a problem solver and a hard worker and have a passion for farming. And then we'll build the cultivation plan into the business plan. And off they go for 2 to 3 years under our tutelage. We have a farm manager. We will have a food and nutrition director to address some of those preparation issues once you get that rutabaga out of the ground. And then from there on, we will roll them out in a smooth transition once their financials are strong, their operation is strong, and they will own that operation from day one. So they need to feed their families and make their own businesses work with our help.
So giving them a chance to get some of the kinks out before they go all out, Suzanne, is that it?
It's, you know, the model is, and Charlie will be familiar with this, it's just like a resident coming out of medical school. We don't let doctors operate on you until they've had a residency. And, you know, in the same way with the farmers, you know, this is an honored profession, and our young people especially really are not in touch with that. And that's why, you know, here locally we're working with Kennett High School to learn how to grow in the greenhouse and, you know, taking that curriculum all the way down to preschool and then bringing it all the way up to Granite State College, who's a great partner with us and is ready to, you know, put a sustainable agriculture degree on the table once we get 10 to 12 of these hard-charging young farmers put together.
So is this your first season, Suzanne?
This is our first season. We are raring to go.
And how many people have you got signed up?
We have about 6 farmers ready to go right now, and, you know, we are just breaking ground, and I get emails and calls all the time. Gee, I'd really like to be a farmer, but I don't have money. I have student loans. I have, you know, bills. I don't know what I'm doing, which end of a hoe to hold. So, you know, but they're really passionate, and they really want to get going. And so we are, you know, creating this really cool nucleus of farmers that are experienced and coming in and doing seminars and also, you know, microcredit so that we can get some of the folks working with some capital. And we are putting together an industry group of just farmers for microcredit. So, you know, they can talk about, you know, how do we deal with tomato blight, as well as, you know, how are you going to balance your budget at the end of the year?
So, right, and as we heard from Ross Cattell, sometimes the business side is hard. You know, you love to grow, you've got a green thumb, but the business financing and accounting and everything can be difficult. So you've got 6 people signed up. Suzanne, how many slots do you have?
Well, what we're doing is we're working off of a base of about 50 acres. And as we're able to finance new farmers coming in, we will just add them. And we will expand our land base. Also, this program is scalable and it's replicable. So it can go anywhere from, you know, Plaftow to Pittsburgh. And we can put people in place there. And, of course, we also help existing farmers. I call it outpatient therapy, where, you know, we'll get in the car and we'll drive down to a farm that says, gee, you know, I really don't understand Quicken or how to do my books. You know, we'll put them in touch with an accountant and we'll kind of get them started. And it's very much around the kitchen table.
Wow. So who's funding all these programs? As I understand, the farmers can come there for free.
That's true. We will underwrite them for the first year of production. And we are extremely dependent upon corporate sponsorships and grants and donations.
Well, Suzanne,
we are a private 501c3.
Good luck with your first growing season there. And I'll keep up with what you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Laura.
That's Suzanne Brown, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Agriculture and Forestry, which just opened up in North Conway. More of your calls after a short break. Stay with us.
I'm Ken Rudin.
There you go again.
As NPR's political junkie, coming to New Hampshire is a bit like
lipstick,
especially in an election year.
Read my lips.
Join me and Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan when we come to the Granite State for an evening of
truthiness.
Join Ken, Neil, and NHPR's Laura Kanoy in Manchester on June 16th. You can reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Sponsored in part by Nathan Wexler and Company, CPAs and Business Advisors.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and from Kentuckook River Canoe Company of Concord, hosting an on-water demo day Sunday, May 23rd, with over 200 canoes and kayaks to try online at kentuckookcanoe.com. And from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, turning investments into loans and education to create opportunity and transform lives. Information at communityloanfund.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we end our week-long series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In, with a look at food safety. Email us your comments or concerns before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, how much can local food be part of New Hampshire's overall food supply? Right now, it's a pretty small percentage. We're looking at efforts to boost those numbers, and let's hear from you. What more could be done, in your opinion, to strengthen New Hampshire food? If you've tried to eat more locally, what are some of the challenges that you faced in trying to do that? If you're a farmer or a restaurant owner, what are you doing to cater to the increasing number of people who want to eat local? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Sarah Zoe, Charlie Burke, let's go back to our callers now and go next to Craig in Portsmouth. Hi, Craig, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for doing this series. I think it's terrific and important. I just wanted to make a plug and a comment about my milkman. We have in the Seacoast a milkman, and we're customers, and it's just like you think of a milkman with the glass bottles and the little galvanized box on the front step. They deliver more than milk, but it's a great convenience to our family. But the thing that we like the most about it is that our milk, all the milk that we drink now because of the milkman, is all from a farm in North Haverhill, New Hampshire, Hatchland Farm. And we think it tastes better, but we love the fact that it's New Hampshire milk, and that we were able, actually last month, took the kids up to see the farm and to meet our farmer, and they wondered how such sweet, yummy milk could come from something that smelled so bad, but that was part of the experience for them, and we just thought it was terrific. And the what's going on, we learned a lot about what's going on with dairy farmers, and of course all the dairy farms that have gone out of business.
Right.
You know, we pay more for our milk that comes, but you know, the milk has become such a commodity, I understand, that it costs farmers more to produce milk than people pay for it. I know I can go down to my local gas station and get a gallon of milk for $2.69, and I know I pay a lot more for that, but we're happy to do it.
Well, Craig, let me ask our guests, and I think I'll turn to you, Charlie Burke. What about dairy? We've done a couple programs just in recent years about the struggle of dairy farmers. What possibility does this local war movement have for local dairy farmers?
Well, I'll have to say I'm not an expert on dairy, but I do know that Hatchland, for example, is selling most of its milk in bulk out of state. And so the more they can sell locally at prices that they can live with, the better they are. And it's ridiculous, I think, to have great milk like this shipped out of the state and the market, the supermarket's full of milk that comes from somewhere else. So the dairy farmers, I know in Samerton there used to be 35 just 30 years ago, and there is one now.
Really? Wow.
So the more they can sell retail or at market wholesale prices, the more farms will be green and not turn into condominiums.
What about cheese, Sarah Zoe?
Oh, we need more.
That seems like a big area of potential. Vermont has tapped it very well.
Absolutely.
New Hampshire?
And part of it is, you know, realizing that business opportunity and coming up with some capital and some good workers and some people that have some experience and knowledge about cheese making. We're fortunate in the Seacoast area to have, you know, some cheese making starting up at Brookford Farm, a local dairy, and now they're making camembert and fresh mozzarella. And so it's expanding, but we could definitely use a lot more. And it is an opportunity to keep that dairy in the state and to keep it, you know, saleable at a better price as well. It's diversifying the product line of a dairy.
And Roscatel talked about more value-added products, and cheese is a perfect example of that. Did you want to jump in there real quick, Charlie?
I just want to make sure everyone knows there is a New Hampshire Cheesemakers Guild, and there are about 12 or 14 licensed cheesemakers, some of which are selling cheese at Formaggio Kitchen in Boston, which is one of the leading cheese companies, stores in the country.
Well, and as we look at cheese and on the seacoast in your area, Sarah Zoe, we should also look at fish. Some of the state's fishermen are now looking at the community-supported agriculture model that produce has used successfully. This is where consumers buy a share in advance with the promise of fresh local fish. Joining us now for more on that is Charles French, community development specialist and professor of natural resources and the environment at UNH, and he is part of this effort. And Charles French, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Laura.
Well, when and how did you get started with all this, Charles?
Well, a couple of years ago, let me set the stage for the listener a little bit. Many of you probably know that the commercial fishing industry has really struggled over the last few years. It's primarily due to the downturn in the economy, and it's impacted demand for fish, both domestically and locally, and it's pushed down prices. And it's gotten to the point where commercial fishermen were really having to ask themselves, you know, is it worth going out and steaming out in the boat to catch fish, knowing that the profits they make might not even cover the cost for fuel and such. So so we decided, my colleagues at UNH Cooperative Extension and the Sea Grant Program, that we really needed to do something to increase the profitability of the seafood industry. And so we started, following from the model that has been used in agriculture, including the CSA model, we decided that we really needed to build these stronger connections between fishermen and local consumers. And there really hadn't been a strong connection previously.
So how does it work, Charles?
Well, it's the same as the community-supported agriculture model. Essentially, New Hampshire fishermen, there are two what we call community-supported fisheries in the state, and fishermen basically sell shares of seafood, a weekly share, to consumers, and the consumers pick up the share at a drop-off spot. And we have the Yankee Fishermen's Co-op has a CSF that started this past year with shrimp, and Eastman's Fresh Catch has one that they sell a variety of fish year-round. And there are several hundred members that have joined these two CSFs so far this year.
How many fishermen, then, do you have involved in this?
There are about 60 fishermen that participate in the Yankee Fishermen's Co-op.
That's a lot.
Yes, it's a lot. We think we have probably around 100 commercial fishermen in the state right now.
So, Charles, I have read that some of the problems you're bumping into is processing.
Yes. One of the limiting factors to establishing these direct connections, primarily with retailers, is really the lack of processing, like we heard in the meat sector as well. Places like large retailers like Hannaford, they're not interested in buying whole fish. They want a product that's cleaned and filleted so that they can market it. And unfortunately, in New Hampshire, we do not currently have a processing facility. So we're looking to build that capacity, and we have a couple of things going on that are really we have some funding sources that we've identified that can possibly help us to get a processing facility up and running in the next year or two.
Because in some cultures, people would go down to the dock and buy a whole fish and go home and cut its head off and its tail off and do what they need to do, but not here.
Correct. I think people, and we talk about the same issue, that people, one, they want to buy a fish that's already cleaned, and two, I think they don't know how to cook it. So also we need to provide education on how you actually can cook certain fish. And so we're providing recipe cards along with this effort.
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
That's Charles French, again, Community Development Specialist at UNH, part of an effort to develop local direct markets for seafood from New Hampshire. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Sarah, Zoe, Charlie, let's go back to the phones. And David's calling from Enfield. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Yes. Good morning, Laura, and thanks for taking my call. I'm involved with Blue Ox Organic Farm in Enfield, and the question for you and your people there are, is there a differentiator? Is there a value added for the difference between locally grown and locally grown organic? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you,
David. Thank you. And I like the name of your farm.
you eat our produce, actually. We deliver to Concord.
Oh, you're part of the Concord CSA.
Yes,
okay, great. Thanks for calling in. You know, we touched on this a little bit yesterday, Sarah, Zoe, the difference between local and local organic.
And I would say that having the ability, customers are certainly looking for local organic foods, and that it's a really great way for people to get what they want with a label. I would also say that one of the greatest values of local foods is the ability to have a full relationship with the person producing your food. And while organic might be a label that helps you start and get what you want out of your food, that, even David probably knows farmers who are, you know, right there with him in growing practices, but have for whatever reason chosen not to get the organic certification. And that might help David, you know, start with a great customer base, but I don't think he wants his customers to end there. He probably wants people to understand fully his practices and how he returns health to his soil. And that label is a good entryway, but it's really all about being able to ask those deep questions and understanding the answers that you get from the producer, which is not always easy as well. But it's a good entry point.
What do you think? You look like you want to jump in, Charlie.
Well, we are a certified organic farm, and I wear the local hat much more than organic in the farm-to-restaurant connection. But I think there are some people that definitely believe in getting organic vegetables. And we've got some really good large farms around here that do grow organically. But I think local makes sense just as well because of all the issues of shipping and the impact on the environment of bringing the 3,000-mile strawberry to market. We have a stream on our property that goes into Lake Winnipesaukee, so I don't want to be leaching stuff into that. So that's another reason. But local trumps organic now as far as what our mission is with our organization.
And someone said that on the program earlier this week in terms of customer desire. Here's an email from Veronica in Manchester. She says, I'm the president of the Manchester Food Co-op. Please talk about co-ops as a viable option for year-round food supply source for communities throughout the state. Either of you want to tackle that one? Charlie?
I think that's a great point. We are getting farmers more and more aware of extending, as we've already talked about this week, is with the winter farmers markets, and people aware that having dried beans and stuff that stores is becoming increasingly important and will add to their bottom line. And certainly this is these are great outlets. We go out to shop the co-ops ourselves, Joanne, my wife, and I, and it's a great point.
And I think co-ops, depending on the facility that they have or that they can retrofit, might be a part of that food storage in the winter and
Absolutely.
Being able to build, maybe a root cellar within the co-op.
If and you don't have also, one in your own house.
That's right. And also, again, help to bring people together in those relationships that really understand, the costs of things and buying into it together.
And Veronica, I appreciate the email. And we got a call from someone who's trying to start a food co-op in Keene earlier this week. And yet, Sarah Zoe, a lot of people I know won't shop at the food co-op because they feel like they'll spend twice as much money. How do you get around that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, part of me wants to ask people to start with something. You don't have to switch all of your food buying, but can you start with eggs? Eggs are one of those foods that I want to say they're a gateway food, because once you taste a local egg, how do you go back to the commercial
gateway
variety?
Food.
They're just that much more delicious in their taste, and they're a really great way to make a big impact in a farmer's stability and income, but also in your own health and diet and in the environment when you can buy a locally raised egg over a commercial one. So you don't have to do everything, but if you can start somewhere, eggs are one suggestion. They're summertime vegetables, of course, at farmers markets are another. If you aren't ready to, switch most of your buying dollars, switch some of them.
Let's go next to Brentwood. Michael's there. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling into the exchange.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I work for 4-H here. I'm actually a colleague of Charlie French because 4-H is also part of UNH Extension. And a little bit of a plug, but also a hello to Sarah Zoe, who agreed to come and judge a big cooking event that we had recently this winter. It's an annual event, and when you had a caller call in and comment that we need to go back to home ec, and it made me think about how do we teach local foods, the buying, where to get it. I mean, Sarah mentioned that her whole organization was began as an information source. How do we connect people? And I'm just seeing in 4-H as a place, very New Hampshire, very volunteer-driven, community-based, where kids are learning how to cook, where there's an agricultural history there of teaching agriculture through extension, through 4-H. And I'm seeing a lot of interest, and I'm trying to personally just get the word out to folks that are really interested in trying to figure out how to engage and learn about this, that we can come together, form clubs, get our kids involved. We're actually part of the Heron Pond Barnard School project that I guess you must have had Andre on maybe yesterday. So anyway, just a little bit of a plug for 4-H, and I guess also a question to the callers is, thinking about if we do have this resource where families can come together and learn, or what would you suggest to me as I try to leverage 4-H's resources to help people learn how to do local foods?
Okay, Michael, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Charlie?
Well, I can remember 4-H when I was growing up, but I think that most of the members are in the farm community now, and I guess the challenge would be getting membership from non-farm families and introducing them and integrating them, and that is something that I think would be considered to reach this goal.
Just to wrap up with both of you, and Charlie, I'll start with you. What's the number one thing that you can do in your own organizations to boost this local food number? Is it the processing? Is it the state support? Is it getting the word out? What is it?
I think that solving the distribution problem is the first thing. I think we've underestimated the capacity in New Hampshire. A very quick story. Last year, I was talking with a local farmer who sells to Hannaford's and Stop and Shop, and so Hannaford's rather. And he mentioned he had some stuff left in the field. And it was late October. And I called the folks at the food bank and I said, would you like to glean 10,000 pounds? From
wow.
a small farm in Samerton. So I think we're underestimating what's out there, and if we can get the connection between the consumer and the farm, we'll solve a lot of the problem.
Great. What do you think, Sarah Zoe?
I agree that, you know, we do have these challenges in processing, but there is a lot of food to be had, and I hope that everyone who is interested in local food believes that, you know, they'll be able to get what they want and to look around, to go on the New Hampshire Department of Ag website, find a farmer's market near you, go to it, and if you can't regularly go, make a connection with a farmer and go to their farm when you can.
Okay, Sarah Zoe Patterson, it was really nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Zoe Patterson, founder and coordinator of Seacoast Eat Local. Charlie Burke, good to have you. Thank you.
And thank you for doing this series.
Charlie Burke, co-owner of Weatherhill Farm in Sanborton, president of New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant Connection, co-founder of the New Hampshire Farmers Market Association. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producer is Dan Ankeles. Our intern is Emily Johnson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.